Welcome to Apparently, the podcast for absolutely average parents. I'm Ann Johnsos.
And I'm Tracy Weiner. Ann and I have been friends for a very long time.
We met right after college.
Yeah, and our first jobs as radio producers.
We spent our 20s as wing women for each other, and it didn't work out very well.
But then it did, and we found the right guys and stood up in each other's weddings.
And then we had babies within weeks of each other, so we went from producers to reproducers.
We make it look easy.
Which brings us to this podcast. We want to discuss topics that interest us and you and provide some knowledge to other average parents.
We're average, not experts. So we'll tackle these topics with people who know what they're doing.
Yeah, we'll get the experts. And I fully expect to embarrass myself along the way.
Yeah, after season one, I'm pretty sure we already have.
So welcome to Apparently.
We make it look easy. We make it look good. When everybody sees it, they stop and take a look.
Apparently, vaping is now an epidemic.
Yes.
Especially among young people. And the medical community does not know exactly what to do about it. We talked about vaping in season one.
Yep.
But a lot has changed since then. The Centers for Disease Control just released new numbers about the multi-state outbreak of lung disease. There are 380 cases of lung illness.
Wow.
Yep, reported from 36 states and one U.S. territory. And as of this recording, seven people have died from vaping-related illnesses.
Seven. It's up to seven now?
Yep.
Wow. We've talked about Juul, and it's the biggest brand in e-cigarettes. And court documents in a North Carolina case against Juul reported e-cigarette use between 2017 and 2018 increased by 78% amongst high school students.
78% in 1 year.
Yes.
Yeah. And I heard a stat yesterday that one in four high school students is now vaping.
Wow.
Yeah. So Juul's share of the e-cigarette market has gone from 24% to 75%. So Juul is really right up there. And it's a brand name that's so well known, it's become a verb.
Yeah, that's what everyone, they're like, I don't vape, I Juul.
Yeah. There was a story about a doctor who was like, do you vape? And the kid in the room was like, no. He said, you do not smoke e-cigarettes? No. Do you Juul? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I Juul. So, yeah.
According to the lawyers in the North Carolina case, Juul deliberately designed the flavors and even the look to appeal to the younger audiences and has chosen social media platforms and marketing campaigns that are known to attract minors. So it's intentional.
Yeah, and the packaging looks like candy. The advertisements use models who look like teenagers. So the industry is reacting, or the government is reacting. In the past few days, we've seen calls for banning the flavored e-cigarettes. And so in Michigan and New York, Chicago, even President Trump. I guess the belief is the flavors are a way to lure young people and get them started, and then they'll be addicted.
Yeah. Blueberry, bubblegum, like what are the fancy flavors?
Pop Rocks and creme brulee. Remember last year when we talked about this? Sour Patch Kids, you know, it's to attract people who wouldn't necessarily be attracted.
Yes, my daughter was at a sporting event and said, I smelled something and it smelled fruity, and then everyone's like, ah.
Oh,
so she didn't. She's like, what's that smell? And
that's it was vaping?
Yes.
Oh, God.
So Dr. Milan Han is a professor of internal medicine in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine in the University of Michigan Health System. She's also the director of the Michigan Airways Program and a national spokesperson for the American Lung Association. Thanks for joining us, doctor.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start from the basics, okay? Because I'm a rookie. I've never done it. I've never seen it, like, in my hand. How does vaping work, and what are the risks associated with it?
So, essentially, whether we're talking about electronic cigarettes that at least look a little bit more like conventional cigarettes, or whether we're talking about the Juul product, which, if you've seen, it actually looks almost like a thumb drive in its shape, there are a couple of basic components. Essentially, there's a replaceable cartridge that contains the vaping material, nicotine, flavorings, as we've been discussing. And then there's another chamber that's got a vaporizer, something to heat it up to turn it into vapor. And then there's usually a battery compartment. So that's sort of the the basic setup of these devices, even though some of them look a little bit different.
And what are the risks about, you know, when we talked about this last year, we talked about, you know, everyone knows about smoking and you're getting tar and you're getting nicotine and you're getting chemicals. What are you getting with vaping and what are the risks?
So this is unfortunately, I think, one of the things that's really not come out. And I actually place some of the blame on the FDA. And I think their silence on this issue has been interpreted as the general public equals safety.
Mm-hmm.
And that is clearly not the case. So interestingly, one Juul pod contains more nicotine than an entire pack of cigarettes.
Oh. One cartridge?
One cartridge.
Wow.
And then on top of that, there's all this other stuff they don't talk about, like propylene glycol, heavy metals, diethylene glycol, cadmium, benzene, other things. I mean, when you think about combustion, there's a lot of other stuff that happens when you vaporize this material, and they have to put the nicotine into something. So when we think about risks, we know nicotine itself is addictive. But when we think about the traditional cigarettes, we have a lot of data over many, many years to know what the long-term consequences are. So we know that patients or individuals that smoke are increased risk for heart disease, for lung cancer, for emphysema. And I think this is something the general public is aware of. Unfortunately, the e-cigarettes are so new that we just don't have a lot of long-term data upon which to base safety claims. So there are certainly a lot of carcinogens in the acetaldehyde and formaldehyde families that are in vaping products. And so we need more data, more long-term data. But I think the potential for some of the same harms that we see with cigarettes is still there. We just don't have enough data to prove it. But if you think about the lungs themselves, they were not designed to do anything other than breathe clean air. Now, they do filter a certain extent. If you were to cut open a lung, which I've done, of a patient that's smoked, you'll find all sorts of tar and stuff that the body is trapped and prevented it from getting to the rest of the body, so that's good. But there's only so much that the lungs can take, and there are actually known lung diseases for all whole sorts of different people that work in different work environments that are exposed to different kinds of vapors and fumes from, say, a production factory or from a construction site. Inhaling lipids, for instance, fatty substances, is known to cause a very specific type of pneumonia. So while the data is lacking, I can certainly come up with a lot of things that are in e-cigarettes that would lead me to concern. And then the new outbreak that we have, this epidemic of lung disease that we believe is directly related to e-cigarettes, I think further enforces our concerns around safety.
So the reports of the vaping-related illnesses, this outbreak we're talking about, they span the country, but they're not all the same. And many of the patients were vaping THC, which is the compound in marijuana that makes people high. And I know you can't speculate about what's causing the outbreak, but can you tell us if the standard e-cigarette is just as dangerous as one with THC?
Well, the THC molecule itself is not known to have lung-specific risks. Certainly there are other things, you know, other effects that are, I think, well described. But the problem is that none of this is regulated. So who knows what they're dissolving the THC in? And at least with the Juul product, and I'm not arguing for its safety, but it's, you know, a large corporation that probably has a certain amount of at least quality standards.
Yeah, quality control.
In place.
Yeah.
The THC-related products are going to be from much smaller manufacturers. And so, it's not so much, I have to admit, it's not so much the THC compound that concerns me with respect to it's just all the other things that you don't know are in those,
in the,
you know,
pod?
Potentially in the devices that are being used to deliver it. So, we just don't know enough. Not all of the cases have been linked to concurrent THC vaping. So I don't think you can say to someone, or if there's a parent out there listening, and how, you know, I know we all want to protect our children, I don't think you can tell people, well, as long as you avoid THC products, you're safe. Right. I just don't think that's the case right now.
What are some of the symptoms of the vaping-related illnesses? What should we do if you suspect your kid has one of these related illnesses?
Right. So I have to admit, I've not personally seen a case, although we do have one confirmed case in where I live, which is Washtenaw County in Michigan. But from what I've seen, it appears to be consistent with an acute lung injury, so a non-infectious pneumonia. So you're going to have a lot of the same symptoms, shortness of breath, cough, in some cases, maybe a fever. You know, and then when these patients are being brought in, there's, you know, infiltrates in the lung that we can see on chest x-ray, and they have a hard time maintaining their oxygen levels, and in some cases ended up on ventilators, and as you had mentioned, have died. So I think if you have a teenager or a young person or a friend that is experiencing any type of new respiratory symptoms, and, you know, they really need to go and just get checked out by their physician, stop vaping and get checked out by the physician, because at this point, without, you know, further medical evaluation, it would be difficult for a non-medical person to know for sure.
To know, okay.
So you mentioned infiltrates in the lungs, and I read somewhere that the problem could be the oil used to vaporize the nicotine.
I've heard this too.
So what types of oils are used, and why are they dangerous? And then I read something about vitamin E being one of them.
So vitamin E is sort of interesting because, you know, you can buy it at the drugstore, right? I've taken vitamin E supplements. I've rubbed it on my skin. And so in general, you know, there's a lot of oils that would probably fit into that category. But the problem is that the lungs were not designed to be inhaling oil. And it's been, you know, lipoid pneumonia, a lipid-based pneumonia, is something that's been previously described for people that have had accidental exposures to inhaling oils. So what I would say is that almost any oil, regardless of of whether it may be non-toxic, again, if rubbed on the skin or used in, you know, lotions or even ingested, may have a very different reaction within the lung. We just were not designed to be inhaling oil. You know, we've evolved over, or whether you ascribe to evolution or whether you ascribe to creation, we were not either evolved or designed to be inhaling oil.
Okay, what about the flavors? Are they more dangerous than the non-flavored cigarettes, e-cigarettes, or is that just the problem that it's just a way to lure the kids to think it's cool? Like
so I am not aware that any of the flavored additives themselves are toxic or dangerous, again, beyond the fact that I mentioned none of this really should be going into your lungs. But I think the concern from the medical community's perspective is that exactly what you said, that these are being used to, you know, lure kids. I mean, if you look at some of the packaging, you can't even tell what it is. Like, is this juice? Is this gum? Is this candy? I mean, many of these just look like food items.
That's what we did a year ago. We talked about this right before it really became like a big national story. And I just don't understand. Like, I grew up, you know, people smoked cigarettes at my grandpa and grandma and everyone, and my mom did. And then there was this anti-smoking, and then, you know, most public places, like, laws were passed that you can't smoke in restaurants and so on. And, like, generally speaking, my kids are like, smoking's bad. It's bad for you. What the hell is, what happened here? I don't understand. Like, is it because of these blueberry flavors that kids are like, oh, it's not really a cigarette? Like, what? Is it a branding thing? Do we just all drink the Kool-Aid?
And it looks like Kool-Aid.
Like,
well, I think it's twofold. It's one, direct marketing to kids. And two, with cigarettes, we had stronger protections in place against allowing these into the hands of minors. Again, the FDA has failed to regulate. And so I think the absence of any consistent messages has resulted in an assumption of safety on the part of the public. And I think that's the real problem. And to a certain extent, lack of long-term data on, you know, we as physicians can hypothesize that after 10 years, your lungs may have severe damage, but we just don't have enough long-term data to, you know, have been able to
back,
you know,
it.
Go around it and back it. But having said that, with the current outbreak, I think, unfortunately, we're getting some of that safety data that we need to go to the public and explain how concerning it is. But I will tell you, it's tough. So one thing that's interesting and may interest your listeners to know is that when, you know, very early on, the American Lung Association and the American Thoracic Society in the U.S. came out very strong with concerns, you know, about vaping. And the British Thoracic Society actually decided to take a slightly different take on the subject. And we're focusing more instead about how, you know, it might be beneficial to help people quit smoking. So I think with the current crisis, they're potentially rethinking that statement. But there really is not, you know, in case, you know, and that was, I think, really one of the ways that this has really been marketed, is that, oh, you know, you can use this to quit traditional cigarettes. It's safer than traditional cigarettes. But, you know, roughly about 10% of smokers who have used e-cigarettes have been able to quit, compared to roughly 27% of people who've been trying to quit who did not use e-cigarettes. So the data, and we had talked about the fact that the nicotine in one is about the nicotine in an entire pack. So, I mean, just imagine we're in some ways creating higher addictive potential than less.
Yeah, because you hear stories about, like, the kids are going through pods a day. That's a pack of smokes a day.
Yeah, it's scary. It's very scary.
Well, speaking of sort of how kids or people in general are consuming, a report on CNN said part of the problem is the way people approach the vaping devices. So can you explain what a puff flow rate is? Is that?
Okay, I have to admit that when I saw this, I laughed a little bit. And the reason is that we as physicians, as a pulmonologist, I prescribe a lot of medications that are inhaled. And those are for, you know, patients with asthma or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. We give them medications to help open up the airways. And a lot goes into creating those devices. And so we will measure peak inspiratory flow rates on patients, how quickly they're breathing air in. And we have training devices that we will give those patients to make sure they're breathing things in at the right rate for that particular drug, because we want to make sure it gets deposited, not in the back of the throat. We want to make sure it gets down into the lung. So when I saw this, I was thinking about there's so much variability in patients. And it is true that how quickly you breathe something in and probably also how the device is manufactured will impact where, just, you know, if you look at it kind of fluid dynamics in the lungs, it will impact where the majority of the inhaled particles end up depositing. So it was slightly amusing to me to think about something that a concept that many pulmonologists are quite familiar with, but think about really with respect to drug delivery, is a concept that now is being transferred to vaping. But yes, it is true that how quickly, so that's what they're referring to with the flow rate, but how quickly they're bringing in that puff in will impact where the particles are deposited. And it's possible that, based on either the way the device is made or the way it's flavored, that, and also in, you know, differences between individuals, that you may vape one product a little bit differently than another product, which would result in harmful chemicals being deposited at various points of lung. And potentially, I mean, it's just speculation, I think, at this point, but potentially could impact some of the harms that, you know, or potentially have influenced the fact that we're now seeing harms.
And the other thing that I was thinking about, and it was mentioned in this article, was that, it used to be that people would go outside and take a smoke break, and it was mm-hmm. 2 or 3
yeah.
minutes long, and then
right.
they'd go back up to their job, and they'd sit there for a few hours, and they'd go back down, you know, and I remember people standing outside the Tribune Tower
yes.
and when it was freezing out. But now, if you're surreptitious, you could have this in your pocket and you could be vaping all day, not having those quiet little smoke breaks, right?
Yeah, I was actually at a ski resort this winter and going up the lift, and you know how you get on with whoever happens to be in line. And I was just shocked because they were vaping in between runs.
Ugh. Oh my gosh.
And, you know, you kind of think about getting outside, trying to be in the fresh air, you know, and I just, but yeah, it's convenient. You can even vape on the chairlift.
Yeah.
I think it absolutely is concerning, and I don't think we have enough data, for instance, on for people that are vaping, how many devices they're going through. But with the information that I shared earlier about just how much nicotine is one, I mean, just think about how much nicotine that is for one individual. It's frightening, and I think it really underscores the very high addictive potential. I think you mentioned earlier in the call that, I think there's this new report that 27.5% of high school students use e-cigarettes.
Yeah. Ugh, crazy.
So we're a parenting podcast, and we have teenagers now. And what would you suggest to prevent our kids from vaping? Like, you know, I could tell my kid till they're blue in the face, don't do it, don't do it. But it's like, you hear no a lot in the house anyway, yeah. Like, no, can I do this? No. So how can we really pack a punch? Because sometimes you just hear no so much and it's like one more thing you say. Like, how can we really make an impact and get our kids to realize that we are not kidding around? Like, this is the real problem.
Well, and I want to add a side note to that. I read about a doctor who's trying to reach Gen Z, and she's going on TikTok. Trace, you've seen TikTok, right?
I've heard of it. I don't have it, though.
I know. Of course you don't. It's the former Musical.ly, and it's an app where kids used to make music videos. Well, this doctor, her name is Dr. Rose Marie Leslie. She's on TikTok. They have hashtags just like Twitter. And the hashtag vape tricks has more than 175 million views, and it's teenagers posting the way they vape. And so,
what?
Yes.
People watch just to see how they can,
yes,
what
they
rings
smoke,
look like?
Yes, exactly. So,
who cares?
Dr. Leslie, she is out of Minnesota, and she's been posting videos about the harmful effects of vaping. Her followers have increased by 90,000 in the past couple weeks. And she showed an x-ray of what a damaged lung looks like in one of her videos. Is that how we need to get the message home?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about when I was a medical student, and I used to go go into classrooms, and we would have, these kind of dummy lungs. And I remember going and purchasing, I think, my only package of cigarettes ever to plug into this little device that you kind of puff the air into, and all of a sudden your little cotton ball in there goes black. And,
oh, yeah.
And so I think some of those techniques can be incredibly powerful. And again, I think part of it is just that we haven't been having these conversations with our kids, right? So one thing I would point people to is the American Lung Association has a conversation talking guide about how to talk to your kids about vaping.
Oh, good.
And so it's on lung.org. It's a great resource, I think, for parents so that they can be quite, you know, literal in helping them to understand the dangers associated with it. And also, if your kids already are vaping, there are resources there about cessation apps, for instance, that have been designed for kids. Can you believe it?
Wait, cessation apps for kids?
Yes.
Oh, my God. That's so sad.
Yes, I know. The fact that this exists to a certain extent, to me, is just gut-wrenching. But there are resources available that are specifically targeted for children. But I think, so that's one thing. I'm also a parent. My son is six, and I have already showed him the pictures I have on my phone of lungs, because that's part of my research, mm-hmm. Of lungs that have been damaged by chronic nicotine exposure. However, I think it's really important to also think about what we as parents can do in our communities to try to just prevent kids from getting access to tobacco. So one of the things that the American Lung Association and other organizations have been supporting is just increasing the federal age of tobacco sales to 21. Mm. If you think about it, if it's at 18, that means probably you've got some 17 and 16-year-olds slipping in there, and then they're going to be slipping those to the 14 and 15-year-olds that they know. And it's just this kind of trickle-down effect. So the higher up we can go, I think, with restricting access, it will help. I think we've got to get the FDA to act. We need to work on on trying to remove, in particular, you know, illegal products, and just kind of getting the word out, just like you are on your show. So I think it's going to take a lot. It's going to take, public health campaign. The only good thing I think that's come out of this current epidemic is that at least it's becoming a conversation topic in homes.
Yeah.
And parents can have something that they can use to start having these conversations with kids, because I think we're all scared. Parents are scared. So I think the first thing is, you know, you just got to start these conversations, and then you know, see what you can do within your community with respect to legislation.
Well, and Dr. Han, one thing we didn't sort of touch on in this episode is that it's very hard to tell if your kids are vaping, right? A principal at a Chicago school said that she walked through the metal detectors holding 12 different devices, and the metal detectors didn't go off. Yeah, and that kids can vape in the classroom and blow down their shirts. Like, what is there a way that we can even, what should we look for?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Well, and this is just this is a little bit less professional opinion, a little bit more just parental opinion and me.
Mom to mom,
exactly. But I think looking for changes in behaviors, because these devices are highly addictive. So your kids are potentially going to be more secretive, right? If they don't want you to know they've got these devices, then they're going to hide them. They're going to have to slip away to do it. That is one thing.
They're expensive, aren't they?
You know, I have to admit, I don't actually. I don't know.
I don't know either.
You would think that they're going to need the money to go buy them.
Go buy them, yeah. So I'm going to look it up right now and see if I can figure that out. So the starter kit for Juul is $50.
So who has that money?
The official pods are not cheap. Now, if they're buying an off brand, that can be cheaper. But, you know,
that's a lot of babysitting money.
Yes, it is a lot of babysitting money. You know, the sad part is that when the electronic cigarettes first came out, and I have a lot of smokers, adult smokers in my clinic, and, you know, that there was this sort of general perception that, oh, maybe this is safer. You know, sad and not really funny short of it was that most of my patients could not afford to switch to vaping.
Oh, yeah. Ugh. Is there something to look for in terms of whether our kids are being exposed to nicotine? Do they get jittery? Do they get spacey?
Nicotine is a stimulant.
Okay.
So you can certainly, yes, look for signs of jitteriness, hyperactivity. Now, if they're only vaping when you're not around, that's going to be, I think, a little bit
harder to detect,
more difficult. Now, nicotine is present in the urine.
Oh.
So it is something that, you know, that can be tested for. And if parents want to have conversations with their kids and the pediatricians, obviously that's another route to go. And there's other, depending on the age of the child, that could be more challenging. But it is, certainly for adults, when we're doing certain kinds of drug testing for, you know, various things, it is present in the urine.
So you kind of touched on this with the cessation apps and stuff, but let's say you find out that your kid's doing it. I wouldn't know the first thing to do other than to immediately take it away. But they're just going to go, like, do you go to your pediatrician? Do you go to the doctor? Like, I wouldn't know what to do other than just taking it away and saying, don't do it anymore.
Well, one of the problems is that nicotine is highly addictive. So if your child is addicted, then you probably do want to take the child into the doctor. Obviously, first you got to have an honest conversation with them. You got to, but if you've gotten them to the point where they're convinced that they should stop, or they're not sure they should stop, certainly you can take them to their pediatrician. You can have that discussion with them and see if the pediatrician can help. But you would potentially also want the pediatrician's guidance on how to quit. And there are nicotine replacement products that will ease the withdrawal. Those include gums, patches, lozenges, sprays. There's actually even a Nicotrol inhaler. So there are some, you know, both prescription and non-prescription options. There's also a few medications, including bupropion and varenicline, which can help people quit. So, you know, if your child is addicted and doesn't feel like they can just cold turkey quit, then yes, I think it's absolutely worth taking them into the pediatrician, having that discussion, and getting some help in figuring out a cessation plan.
So, Dr. Han, we try to ask as many questions as we can possibly think of, and then sometimes we think maybe we missed something. Is there anything you'd want to add, maybe a message for parents, because, you know, you are a parent and a doctor, something that we can just tell our audience?
You know, I don't think you can start with the messaging too young. So, if you've got really small children, like I've got a 6-year-old, I've already started talking to them about this kind of thing. Because the problem is if you don't have the chance to talk to them and then they get exposed much earlier than you ever thought they would, you know, and then they start using it, it gets much, much harder. And I think kids at a younger age tend to be a bit more receptive.
Yeah.
So I think the message for people with the really young children is it's never too late to start having those conversations, and it's never too early.
Well, you see people walking around. Walking around on the sidewalk, so you could be walking with your 6-year-old and use that
absolutely
a way to broach this topic that's developmentally appropriate for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Never too late, never too early.
Awesome.
I guess that would be my advice.
Okay, thank you so much, Dr. Meilan Han, Professor of Internal Medicine in the Division of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine in the University of Michigan Health System, and also National Spokesperson for the American Lung Association.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So apparently we need to really talk to our kids about vaping. And as she said, it's never too late, it's never too early. Maybe we get online and show them TikTok.
I can't even believe that's crazy, but that's very smart of that doctor.
Very smart. And I think I might show it to the kids.
Remember when we were talking to John Duffy, Dr. Duffy, and he was talking to a 15-year-old, and he's like, but they're really cool.
Yes.
Like, this is like an uphill battle, because these kids think they're just cool devices.
Right.
And that's like the hook.
And then they are hooked.
Then they are hooked.
Yeah.
So it's about branding and packaging and how it seems like a cool thing to carry around. And you got to like dispel that and make them not think that it's that cool.
And I think Dr. Han was right in that we need to involve the community. We need to, as parents, contact the FDA and say, you know, dude, you got to take away these, you know.
I think there's momentum for this right now across the country because of all these new stories. So
let's hope.
We'd love to hear from you about your vaping stories or issues that came up in your family, or any issues in your family.
At all. Yeah.
It gives us story ideas. Give us a call at 331-704-0046.
Like us on Facebook and leave us a review on iTunes.
Yes, please, please.
Tell the parents in your life to listen and suggest topics.
That's right. This is a WGN Plus podcast. I'm Tracy Weiner.
And I'm Ann Johnsos. Thanks for listening to Apparently. We make it look easy. We make it look easy.